Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on the topics that confront newsrooms and some of the ethical decision making that goes into the work every day of newsroom leaders. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. You got something on your mind this morning?
You know, I tend to be a little myopic when it comes to news. I focus on local news or national news and how it's covering our lives. But a report to be published later this month by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is chronicling the impact the loss of U.S. foreign assistance is having on independent media. And I just wanted to take a moment to just talk about a little bit about how bad that is.
The loss of independent media around the world.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take a little bit of a broad look there. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. You got something on your mind today that we should take a look at?
I'd like us to talk about the decision whether to name or not name the officers who shot the protesters in Minneapolis as part of it. And if we have time later, I'd like to talk about the pros and cons of letting AI write your news story, as I've discovered as part of my journalism class at UAlbany.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
We will definitely get to those because those are significant topics indeed. And I think it's important. You know, one of the things, just before we go on to other topics, I just want to talk about a topic that we often deal with, and that is the loss of local news organizations. You know, we've seen this over and over again, where we lost two newspapers a year. Last year, about 3,000 American newspapers have closed since 2005. So we know that there are now vast stretches of the country without information covering their localities. And new research shows, where are people turning instead? It turns out that when local news disappears, people turn to social media feeds, they turn to influencers, and they look at gossip. And I can give you the statistics on that, but I think it's just important for us to note that people have a desire for information. The difficulty is they're not able to access it, not able to access really valuable and useful sources of information. In fact, a subsequent survey found that when people say what they really aren't getting enough information about, it's local news. People find that it's easier to get national and international news they want than news about their neighborhoods, their towns, their cities. So this is frustrating, that the news that we all worked on, those of us sitting in this studio, we were essentially local journalists in our most active days. And that's the news that is disappearing, and that's what people say they can't find a substitute for.
And it's not that that's a new problem, it's just a more pervasive problem. And we could think over the decades, there were lots of, and still are, smaller communities within our, what we would consider our readership areas, that were not covered. And I can remember at the Saratogian, we would start up a weekly paper that would serve, you know, some of the outlying rural communities, and we would go to visit with them and have town meetings. And in my heart, I knew that as soon as this no longer proved to be the economic benefit that the publisher and the ad department hoped that it would be, that it would disappear. And that's exactly what happened. So that was very limited, and you felt that our coverage area was shrinking and shrinking. So there's lots of places that have been news deserts for a long time. Now it's more pervasive.
You know, I live in a small town, and I can tell you that it's true about social media and the gossiping that happens about what's happening, who's involved. In some respects, the truth can be found out if you go through these long threads, but there's always bad information in there. And I felt a little bit of a ricochet because we're looking at this, you know, this Medill study about what's happening with the news deserts, and contrast that with new Pew research that says Americans are saying, we've got too much news, you know, and it's too much of the wrong kind of news. It's too much of the sensational political bickering. So what you're not getting is that true local news. What's happening, or even the good community news, you know, about the local characters. You know, you don't see that. And so you're not getting the community, a cohesion that I think you used to get from a local newspaper.
Yeah. The first newspaper I worked for full time, I was in a small community in Indiana where there was a very active Little League program. And that summer of my internship, I went over and took pictures of every one of the 16 Little League teams, all these kids kneeling on the field in their uniforms. And we put the picture on the front page. And this is just great, you know, to have all these pictures of kids. And that kind of community journalism really stitches communities together. That's lost. And you can get some of that on social media, I guess. People will post stuff about their own kids, but it's not the same as having a local newspaper that does it, right?
What you're missing is the vetting or the curation that you get from an editor or an organized journalism operation. And I think that's hard to replicate in a haphazard way, as is happening in social media.
Is it good news, then, that your old organization, Judy, the Gazette News Group, as it's now called, is buying more newspapers? This has just been announced that the Adirondack Daily Enterprise and the Lake Placid News are being bought by the Gazette.
You know, these creations of these mini chains is something that's happening across the nation where one organization will gather up local newspapers that are struggling. It's hard to say what will happen. I mean, coming together as a chain offers some economical advantages. Let's hope that what we're going to see as they save money on, you know, the back end of the system, they put into real regional reporting and to serve those communities. I mean, I love those Adirondack papers. I just thought they were great. I'm glad to see them continuing. In that respect, what we're happy to see is the papers continue. What I'm looking forward to is seeing real reporting, a real financial commitment to the news side of the operation.
I was interested in hearing your take on it as a former employee of the operation. I know that the jury is out and time will tell, but this is not the first expansion. The Daily Gazette bought up the Amsterdam paper and the Gloversville paper, and then they added Catskill and Hudson, and now the North Country
and Spotlight
papers.
And Delmar.
And the Spotlight and Delmar, and the person who was the publisher of that is now a managing editor for all of those publications based at the Gazette headquarters. So the question is, what are they going to do with those resources? Yes, you have one team selling ads or talking about how to if circulation, but you still need bodies. What are they going to do with the newsroom as far as coverage for those areas?
It's very hard. In my time at the Times Union, we considered going into Clinton Falls and either buying that paper or establishing our own team up there, and decided that it wasn't really a great fit because of the distance. And this distance from Schenectady to the Adirondacks is even harder, you know. So I think it will be interesting to see. I mean, credit to John DeAugustine, the publisher, now owner of the Gazette, for keeping the papers alive. But it is more than, as we see at the Washington Post, it's not just keeping a label on a paper. It's trying to support the journalistic enterprise.
So the hope to me is that because it's truly still a local enterprise by local people, it's not the Hume family anymore, but maybe they will be committed to, in order to succeed, they're going to have to provide coverage and advertising that the readers are going to want. When the Saratogian and the Troy Record became sister papers under the same management, all the people were nice and everybody was great working together, but the company's mission was just to squeeze as much out of us as possible. And I remember they said, oh, now we can have one website called capitalcentral.com for the Troy and Saratogian. And one of my many fights with corporate people, it was like, that doesn't mean anything to people.
Right.
And seeing Troy News in the Saratogian and vice versa is not going to be a positive. And it wasn't.
It wasn't. It can't work. I mean, actually, I worked for that company. I was the editor of the Record in the early 90s, predecessor, actually, of the company that at that time. But I remember this laughable moment. Laughable, except it was kind of tragic, when the CEO of the company came in and explained to me, we're taking this paper down market, down, down, down. And he didn't really know the community at all, but he thought that there was more money to be made by going to the working class readers. And he said, you know, your pals aren't going to like you at your fancy cocktail parties in East Greenbush.
He doesn't know you go to Big Shots for your dough.
The man does not know East Greenbush. He had just looked at the numbers that said, well, that was the highest demographic in Rensselaer County at the time, which shows non-resident ownership can really kill a journalistic value as well. That was dumb.
I think we as a news industry have also given up on this notion that having competing news operations in the same city. We're losing that. And that offered the advantage of one reporter fighting another reporter for the scoops. And it lent a degree of enterprise to news gathering that I think we've given up on.
Yeah. By the way, the Adirondack Daily Enterprise had an idiosyncrasy that I have not seen in any other newspaper. All the direct quotes are in italics. You ever notice that in their stories? Do they still do that? That was really an odd thing in print. Every direct quote was in an italic paragraph. It was strange.
I don't know, but they are and will continue to be, I hope, a scrappy little paper.
That would be wonderful.
Yes, I agree.
Hope so. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo. By the way, we love to hear from you. David in Niskayuna says, the Media Project is one of my favorite programs. I always find myself intrigued with the topics and discussion of the panel. I just wish it were an hour. And thank you also, David, said nice things about the Upstate American, which I publish now. Here is Jeffrey, who writes, hello, Media Project. Trump might be unraveling after the Obama video was released. I guess he's talking about where the Obamas were depicted as apes. I sat thinking about the whole picture. Trump is a demagogue. He uses anger to galvanize his followers against those who oppose him. Nothing new in that, but this is Trump. His playbook is facile. And if we stop reacting with anger, his strategy will not work. Do you think that different coverage would stop him, would stop this? I don't know.
Anybody who's complied has lived to regret it. I mean, Caitlin Collins is pretty nice to him. She treats him with respect. She never has reacted angrily. The reporters really try to be as professional as possible and not react with anger, and that doesn't do him any good. I mean, we sitting here, we're not in the field, but I think all of us would like to confront him with anger and say, what are you doing to our country?
I think it's a fool's errand to keep asking other people in leadership, what do you think about that? Do you agree? Do you condemn that? You keep asking and asking. You're hoping for the right answer. Are you going to apologize for the murders? Are you going to speak out against what the president posts? Oh, I'm sure it was a mistake, says
Mike Johnson,
House Speaker. And
I think it's unlikely it's a mistake. Right.
and yet you still want to try to put them on record as saying or not saying. But
yeah, it is hard for the reporters in that situation to kind of actually respond to it because on the one hand, as you say, you have to get them on the record, but you know that it's a fool's errand, as you said.
And that posting, you know, he blamed it on a staffer. I would file FOIL for all the staffers who have access to his email at midnight and track that one down. Don't let that one just slide off.
But I wouldn't expend my effort doing that because even if it's true,
you'll
see that and you'll still get a great big so what. I'd rather be asking the people that we want to hold to account for condoning that kind of behavior. How do you consider that decent? Was that a decent thing to do? You know, is that the kind of leadership that we want from our country?
Catherine writes, well, listening to your February 6th show, I was inspired to relate my personal response to Bezos and Amazon. I've never, ever, and will never order anything through or from Amazon. My boycott also includes Walmart. Okay. So that is a voice crying in the wilderness, Catherine self-describes. So
keep baying at the moon. I'm with you. And I wouldn't say that I never order from Amazon, but I rarely order from Amazon. But I'm in a position to be able to find what I need elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So we welcome your thoughts. Media@wamc.org is how you can write to us. All right, you were going to talk, Judy, about disarming the global free press because, as you said, with USAID knocked out, basically, Elon Musk called it a criminal organization, time for it to die. That was providing a lot of support to journalism around the world, right?
Right. And now the Carnegie Endowment has taken a look at the impact of that. And they found that, you know, in 2024, the U.S. spent about $258 million on media development. Not a ton of money, I would say. It was allocated both to USAID and the State Department. They took that money away. And the report also found that European leaders and private foundations have not increased support to meet the shortfall. And in many cases, they've stepped back. And also, we see this Open Society Foundations, which is a George Soros-supported organization, has also reduced its support. And so, you know, I think it's clear that without this U.S. money coming in, these independent local news operations in places like Libya and Eastern Europe will die. And it is to our advantage in the United States to see those operations continue. And without them, tyranny will reign.
You know, U.S. strategic interests were served by aggressive journalism in those places where repressive governments are holding down the interests of ordinary citizens. So getting rid of it really also undermines U.S. strategic interests. And it goes without saying, Donald Trump's disdain for journalists is reflected as well in this policy of cutting off support for news organizations around the world. So it seems nonsensical, but it is to our brother and sister journalists around the world, this has got to be a real sense of betrayal that the effort to support a free press that America encouraged now is leaving them exposed and vulnerable to the repression in their own countries.
I agree.
All right. Barbara, you had a thought about naming the killers in Minnesota.
Right.
What about that?
In newsrooms everywhere for time immemorial, there is serious discussion about whether to name people who might be the victims or perpetrators of crimes, when to name and when not to name. And what has come up lately was ProPublica had decided to name the federal agents, the ICE agents, who shot and killed two people in Minneapolis.
And, I mean, obviously they really paid attention and thought about that as they were doing it, as we always do when we're naming people in such a situation. But wouldn't you opt in favor of that because it pushes transparency, which we should be seeking?
Yeah, I would have thought about it for like 30 seconds, especially because there was some concern that these officers were not going to be published or held accountable or even be suspended for a day or two, and that the early indications from the government were they were just throwing them back on the street. And I think for accountability, I think we need to have those names. I mean, the concern about using the names is that they would be doxxed, that people who thought that this was a very bad decision on their part, that they should be prosecuted, would come after them and their families. Law enforcement officials all over have that concern.
And that is a legitimate concern. But you have masked agents. We don't know who they are. There's no accountability. There's no way to track down who did what if people don't know. And it's difficult to trust the administration, to be honest about all this, when they come out with their pronouncements instantly before anything is investigated. So I think weighing the difficult decisions, because you want to minimize harm, you want to seek the truth and report it fully.
Those are precepts of the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. So
thank
that's
you.
Important there. Yeah.
So I understand people's concerns about protecting the safety of law enforcement. But in this one, 30 seconds sounds about right, perhaps, Judy, because they all need to know that they're all going to be held accountable.
It's not as though anyone is publishing their home addresses.
Yeah, but you can find all of that. Wouldn't it be disturbing if when protesters of the ICE raids are outed to the public? And despite the administration's claims to the contrary, according to reports that I've read, they say there's not a database, but some say there is a database. And why would you even be taking, you know, images of people at the protests if you weren't trying to see who's who?
You know, this notion of the safety of people once information is out about them is something that we do contend with. Minimize harm, as you say, is one of the ethical precepts we follow. I remember when Kirsten Gillibrand, U.S. Senator, bought a home in Rensselaer County, we published a photograph of it. And I got a call from the senator's office saying, do you mind? Are you sure you really want to publish that? That is, publish it online. And I thought, you know, that's a good point. I'm willing to say they bought a home in Rensselaer County, what the town is, but maybe not show people what the look of it is.
So
you think that was a good point?
Yeah, I think that is a good point. I mean, it's an example where just because we in the media know something doesn't mean that we have to publicize it. Of course, nowadays there are people protesting in front of people's houses.
Right.
I got this issue when we published real estate transactions, and people love reading them, but police officers would call me and say, could you please not publish where I live or that I've bought this house in this place, because a lot of people read it and I don't want it in the public record. I tended not to do it. It was a good 15 years ago. But
so you agreed with the request, you mean?
No, I didn't agree with the request. Oh, and we would tough. Still publish it. It was tough. Yeah.
We would have cases where a domestic violence victim
right.
oh, absolutely.
Was
yes,
changing
yeah.
addresses. And
yes.
so that would have to kind of be flagged to us to even know about it. But the people running that agency knew to flag us and we would keep it up.
I think I took out cops' addresses. I'm not sure.
You know, in large part, the decision was based you didn't have the digital dissemination that you do today. It would be just the paper and limited. I know. It was a tough
one.
Eventually, mm-hmm. The problem went away for some reason.
See, I think one of the things that people don't understand who haven't been in newsrooms is how often you're confronted with really interesting and difficult ethical decisions, and you do try to do the right thing. And while we say the expectation, the supposition is that you're going to go forward with information, you do withhold stuff based upon what you think is right, meets those ethical standards. And that's what's different, to go back to our initial conversation, with getting information from gossip or from just haphazard stuff on the web. As you said, there is a curatorial stance by the people in journalism who try to be sure that we're doing the right thing in passing along information to the public.
Well, we need to follow up on that story. The media needs to continue on the alleged investigations into those killings.
Absolutely. So in terms of what people know and what they don't know, the Nancy Guthrie disappearance case has a couple of very interesting journalistic angles to it. First, the danger, perhaps, to celebrity journalists, if we want to call Savannah Guthrie of the Today Show that, in making their lives very public. And then second, how much attention this story has gotten in the media by comparison to a lot of other stories that are out there. People seem to be quite fixated on this, right?
Well, CNN certainly is. But I think people who follow it are interested.
There are elements of the story that are hard to overlook. It's just mystifying. There's no real, people can't understand what happened and why. So there's that mystery that propels it. There's also the fact that Savannah Guthrie is very popular. The Today Show was very popular. And apparently her mother was on the Today Show quite a bit. And so the audience, some people consider, you know, Nancy Guthrie their mom. And we all have moms, or we had moms. And we know that someone who's 84 is vulnerable, and the idea of them being snatched from their bed in the middle of the night is worrisome. I talk to people who are checking their email or they're checking their news feeds, you know, in the middle of the night to see if anything has happened. But in the absence of real developments, there's been tons of just speculation, and the interviews with, you know, law enforcement officials or former FBI officials saying, well, they could be doing this or they could be doing that. It kind of just feeds the online gossip and speculation that I don't think is healthy.
I would agree. It's an example of how the public's attention can be captured by a human interest story that is very relatable. And you have one person who you see her picture, you see her family members. It's a terrible, it's a kind of a crazy, tragic circumstances that seems to, you know, be, so it captures your emotions.
So if you, and that's good, because part of journalism's role is, I think, empathy, notwithstanding J.D. Vance telling us that empathy is overrated. But I think that part of what we do is, in telling these kinds of stories, we're building empathy, which is a fundamental human emotion. And so if you're an executive producer of a network program, what would you do to meet the public interest in this story, the public demand, without overplaying it?
Well, it's
a really
just,
hard thing.
It's not
thing.
Just public demand. You know that the other, you're thinking that the other stations or media companies are covering it, then you don't want to not have something. I think that's a factor. I think they could probably say less about it.
You know, there are other angles about this that I think they're overlooking. It's like almost like it seemed like there have been mistakes in the police investigation. I would look harder at what the FBI has been doing and whether or not Kash Patel has been overly involved, and why is he feeding information to President Trump? I mean, other than this constant speculation, well, maybe, you know, he's an amateur, maybe he's not an amateur. It's a crazy swirl of news that I think people need to step away from.
A crazy swirl of news might be the phrase where we go out on here this week. That is all the time we have for the Media Project. We're grateful to you for paying attention to us, and we thank you for joining us. David Gustina is the producer of the Media Project. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us. Hope we'll see you again next week here on the Media Project. Interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to the Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's
the Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to the Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.